This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Steve Grobman from McAfee.
Ian, thanks so much for having me. As you know, I'm CTO for McAfee. I set the overall technical strategy, focus my team on a lot of next-generation research and development, and work with our product groups to build our next generations of product.
We're in an industry where we tend to overhype things. AI and machine learning are the latest words. Your view from the stage was different this morning. Can you give us a bit more about where McAfee's taking AI and machine learning?
AI, machine learning are incredibly powerful technologies that can enhance the cybersecurity industry to a large degree, but it's as important that we recognize the limitations as well as the power. Especially if we think about one of the key elements of cybersecurity being that there's a human adversary on the other side that is working to evade our detection technology. So when we look at something like AI, we need to understand how could it be evaded by a bad actor. We need to contrast the field by looking at it's different from other uses of AI. So for example, in weather forecasting, as we get better at tracking storms, it's not that the laws of physics change and water decides to evaporate differently to make it more difficult for us to track storms. But that's exactly what happens in cybersecurity. As we use more and more artificial intelligence, machine learning, the focus on adversarial machine learning becomes a key focus area for bad actors. And we know it's actually quite fragile in many cases.
So what is it going to give us? Because we have the same problem here with AI and machine learning as we do with blockchain. There are a lot of alternative technologies that can be used. Many of the AI ML solutions proposed at the moment are little more than very fast analytics. They're not adding intelligence. They're not doing much on their own. They're just refining down the mess so that a security analyst can do a better job.
In many cases, a lot of the AI or ML capabilities we see in the industry is simply making it easier to detect threats that are similar to what we've seen in the past, focusing on training on well-known malicious capabilities. But part of the irony is even the term artificial intelligence is misleading in that it's not actually intelligent. It's taking advantage of the ability to use algorithms, to use some of these machine learning concepts and technologies to be able to detect a broader range of similar artifacts. But we have to recognize that if there's a new threat, there's no magic. So that new threat isn't going to magically be detected by a machine learning model that was trained on the existing set of malware. The other danger that we have in the industry is there's a lot of nuance in how effective a machine learning technology is. And sometimes it's easy for a company or an organization to overposition how effective machine learning is based on the way that they represent it to a customer or to the industry. And we've actually done some interesting demonstrations to illustrate this fact.
If I look around all the startups that keep appearing on my radar, they've all got machine learning in there. But the question that always remains is, how big is your training set? How diverse is your training set? How effective, therefore, can your machine learning solution be?
And there's a lot of nuance to those questions. Part of the challenge is an organization can create a machine learning model that looks amazing, but it's actually not effective at all. As an example, I wrote an article a few months ago where I wanted to demonstrate how you could build something that looked amazing but was actually awful. And so what my model did was it predicted the American Super Bowl. Basically, I had a model that if I was presenting it to you, I could say, look, I put in some interesting input data from the regular season, offensive strength, defensive strength, regular season record, a few other tidbits, and this amazing technology can predict correctly 9 out of 10 games. If you didn't know all of the right questions to ask, such as what you just demonstrated, were those games included in your training set? And understanding some of the fundamental flaws that companies can sometimes use in order to make their models look better. In this case, for demonstration purposes, I did what we call overtrain the model. I actually didn't withhold the test set from the training set, basically violated all of the best known principles of building a good machine learning model in order to show that you can end up with something that looks really good if you don't know how to scrutinize it appropriately. There's a big risk that a lot of companies in the industry are doing just that, especially given that the barrier to entry in using machine learning has come way down.
But how does a customer begin to make that determination? If we think about something slightly different, which is I want to go to a co-location center or I want to use a cloud provider, they will tell me that they have various industry certifications. But we all know that it can take years to have those revoked. You can fail audits two or three times before you get close to a revocation problem. But they won't tell that to a customer. They might, in a rare exception, allow a very large customer to come to site and view the audit reports. Now, in those instances, somebody who understands an audit can make a determination whether to go or not go. In terms of machine learning, this is out of the scope of the buyers. So what do we need to do as an industry to, first of all, understand, is the training, is this basis on which this product is being sold a valid basis? And secondly, how do the buyers begin to build some form of respectable validation process?
There's a near, medium, and long-term approach that we need to think about. Given that very often organizations don't have the technical capabilities to do a deep independent audit of technology of this capability, they're going to need to rely on others. So in the near term, trusting the organizations and vendors that you're purchasing technology from is an important step. Recognizing that some of the well-established players in the industry are going to hire high-quality data scientists that are using high-quality techniques in order to build these models, whereas potentially new players in the industry or those with less stellar reputations might pull some less than stellar implementations of implementing machine learning. In the long run, I do think that the industry needs to establish unbiased, independent ways to assess the effectiveness of technology that is taking into account not only things like detection rates, but also what is the corresponding false positive rate at every detection level, something that in machine learning parlance we call a receiver operator curve, essentially looking at the quality of a model where you look at the detections as a ratio to the false positives. If you think about it, the reason that's needed is I could build a detection algorithm that detects 100% of malware with one line of code. Do you know what that line of code would be? True. So if I didn't care about false positives, I could basically say that my algorithm is going to detect 100%. Anytime it looks at a piece of malware, it will detect 100% of them. And if that one line of code was true, it would do exactly that. Now, obviously, in this ridiculous example, that would be a worthless algorithm because every legitimate piece of software would also get flagged as malware. So we would say it has 100% detection rate, but it also has 100% false positive rate. What we really need to do is understand if we're getting a 99.9% detection rate, at what cost? And that cost is typically at what cost of false positives are we detecting?
But that leaves us two other problems here. The first is you talked about reputation. There are a lot of startups in this business, 500-600 of them at the last time I looked around. They often come out of universities, or in the case of the vast bulk, out of the Israeli Defense Forces. They bring with them some perceived quality, perceived value. They may not have longevity. And if we start to think about reputation and we think of longevity as part of that, that tends to skew everything towards the long-established vendors, and that's not healthy for a market. The second challenge here is that we often rely on reviewers. When reviewing anti-malware, it's very simple to just have a whole pile of malware, a whole pile of emails, fire that at the engine in a virtual machine and see what the hit rates are. And that's how most anti-malware testing is done around the world. When we come to machine learning, the reviewers don't know where they're starting. They don't have the tooling to know how to test and review, yet they're still expected now to provide that buyer's guide. How do we clean up both of those?
Our testing organizations need to understand some of the nuance of machine learning. When they do their tests, they're already, in many cases, looking at not only detection, but also false positives, but understanding how variation of both of those sets will impact results. Things like if you take legitimate applications and pack them, are they then going to be detected? A lot of the startups that were doing malware detection could be fooled by something as simple as running a packer, because such a large portion of malicious applications is packed. The model can actually learn that when it sees a feature such as high levels of entropy or using a commercial packer, that that's very often associated with being malicious. But the higher quality implementations actually start to separate some of that nuance, where they're able to look at a wider range of things in order to not come to just the simple conclusion. That's part of the challenge in the way that we test solutions today, is we're not really looking at testing from a data science perspective, but rather testing from applying traditional test methodologies to a very different state of technology that operates quite differently.
So what do we need to do to change that?
I think it's going to be an evolved process. We likely need to come up with a new vernacular on what modern security capabilities need to be measured effectively. If you look at almost every other industry, there are industry standards that are universally accepted. In automotive, at least in the United States, we have miles per gallon for traditional cars or equivalent for electric cars. In networking gear, you can look at bandwidth. There's these very standard vernacular that is used in almost every other technology, but for whatever reason in cybersecurity, we really don't have that. We have things like detection rate, which is an awful metric because, as I mentioned a minute ago, you know, detection rate by itself doesn't really tell the whole story. So we need to come up with a vernacular that will not only be a higher quality way of looking at the security industry, but be something that is understandable by those who are not data scientists, those that are making some of these purchasing decisions, so that they can more effectively compare and contrast different products and technologies in the industry.
One of the other challenges here, as I look at it from an outside perspective, is the issue of architecture. If we talk about anything around technology, we talk continually about architecture, but we don't do that when we talk about security. Going back to your keynote this morning, you were showing the challenge of trying to roll the machine learning and the threat intelligence into a single engine, and then separating them, putting them in line. If I think about many of the startups, they also go for this combined element. You are showing how that isn't necessarily the best solution.
If you think about using threat intelligence in a solution that is complemented by machine learning, you get a highly amplifying effect. And here's the reason why. It's crazy to try to train an algorithm and then use the algorithm all the time when you actually know the answer to the thing that you're assessing. For example, if I know an application is legitimate, or if I know an application is malicious, why would you send that to a model in order to let the model make that decision? Because you're always going to have an error rate in the model of both misses or false positives. So if you know the answer, and if you can pull those out of what is being sent to your model, you'll get a much higher detection rate and a much lower false positive rate. Putting technologies together in this fashion will ultimately lead to better outcomes, which is ultimately what customers are looking for. At the end of the day, although everybody talks about machine learning or artificial intelligence or any number of other buzzwords, customers really want outcomes. They want the malicious capabilities to be detected or blocked, and they want to make sure that their business operates with minimal impairment. If that's what a product and solution is delivering, they really shouldn't care what the underlying technologies are under the covers. It's a little bit like when you get in a car, if you hit the accelerator and can go 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, that's amazing. And whatever magic the automotive manufacturer built under the hood, other than intellectual curiosity, you really shouldn't care.
One of the issues with outcomes, however, is that we're a very reactive industry. If I look again at some of the promises that I'm hearing from companies, it's that AI and machine learning will allow us to detect those threats that we don't know about. Well, that becomes a bit of a challenge, isn't it? Because if we're doing this by training a model, then we have to have something to train a model on. Unless, of course, we're training a model to be a psychic. So how do we gain those psychic capabilities out of AI and machine learning?
You're making a great point, which is there is no magic. There are distinct examples that we've seen even this year where there's a very new type of threat that we've never really seen in the industry before, that inherently the existing models are going to have challenges detecting. So for example, in January of 2018, we saw in security research the release of the Spectre and Meltdown techniques that could be used to leak data or exfiltrate data through side channel attacks. They were very creative. They were using microarchitectural artifacts and very precise timing mechanisms to move data from either one application to another or moving across process boundaries. And what we saw is those techniques were techniques that were dissimilar to other malicious capabilities that have been used in the past. It shouldn't have been unexpected that all of these models in the industry that purportedly could find new threat attack techniques failed miserably in detecting those techniques, especially in the early days, until they could be retrained and actually learn something new. And it's one of the reasons that we strongly advocate human-machine teaming, where a human is able to intuitively identify new malicious scenarios that may not have been encoded into an underlying model. And recognizing that quickly is extremely important for an organization to ultimately be able to defend their capabilities.
How much are our numbers skewed by the issue of new variants? One of the challenges is, of course, many new variants aren't really new. They could be just two or three lines of code different from a previous variant. And everybody talks about a new sample and a new threat. They're not. We have 20, 30 copies of some malware families that have appeared within a short space of time. How do we, again, roll back and start to be maybe a little more honest with people and say, actually, these are the threats. Here are the variations on a threat. They're not new. They're just slight differences.
It's important to recognize that as those new variants evolve to be explicitly crafted to evade machine learning models, the problem's going to get much worse. One of the real benefits of machine learning is some of these slight tweaks to existing malware were enough to evade signature-based approaches, but because of the non-deterministic nature of machine learning, they could still be detected with machine learning. What we found in our research is if you use techniques that are explicitly intended to manipulate a sample for the purpose of evading machine learning detection, that they can be very effective. And part of the problem is bad actors aren't yet doing this at scale because we're just on the cusp of having enough machine learning detection capabilities deployed to make it worth their while to actually have those more advanced evasion techniques. But it's something that we absolutely need to be ready for as bad actors start using more advanced adversarial machine learning capabilities.
That throws a whole new curve into this. We've had the US government in the last few days announce that it now sees AI as a potential weapon, a military defense issue. As a result of doing that, it's looking to stop the export of technology. The problem is we have an awful lot of open source, an awful lot of community contributions here. We know over the last couple of years that some of the more advanced bad actors have been taking advantage of some of the early AI and some of the early machine learning to model the effectiveness of their attacks. How do we get ahead of them? Because, to be honest, we've never managed to get ahead of them in anything else in this industry.
One thing we have to recognize off the bat is every technology will be used for benevolent and malicious purposes. With the advent of new machine learning techniques, with the lowering of the barrier to entry, anybody can download TensorFlow and build a model very quickly. We need to recognize that bad actors are going to use the technology to make their attacks more effective. If you look at some of the key things that a bad actor needs to focus on, many of them are well suited for machine learning problems. For example, machine learning is good at classification problems. One classification problem that a cyber criminal has is victim selection. Instead of trying to attack everybody in the universe, if you can identify what victims are going to be the highest probability of being compromised or what victims are going to give me the highest level of return on my malicious investment, those are the types of questions that a bad actor can help get answered by the use of the exact same machine learning code that you would use to look at medical research or any sort of other legitimate purpose. Even things like improving the efficiency of social attacks. If you think about a bad actor in the good old days, a bad actor had to essentially choose, did they want to do a phishing campaign where they could have a very large scale but a low victim conversion rate? So they could send the exact same email to a million people, but let's say that only 1% of those people would fall for their phishing scheme. Or they could take the other approach and do spear phishing, where they customize content for a particular user. They look at their Twitter feed, they look at other public information, tailor it so that when the user gets it, they're much more likely to click on the link or download and execute the application. But because it required more work per user, the scale was inherently lower. What machine learning and especially some other forms of AI does is it allows a bad actor to take the best of both worlds, where they can now automate spear phishing content for a much broader set of users. It likely won't be quite as good as human-authored spear phishing content, but it will surely be better than just sending the exact same email to everyone in their database. Similarly, they won't hit the same scale that they would hit with just a single punch it out as many times as you can phishing email, but putting those two together, they get a much higher return on their investment. And what I would say is we need to recognize the reality that once a technology exists in the public domain, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's out there. We need to recognize that. We found this the hard way in the 90s, when we had the cryptography debate on whether the United States should make the export of software containing encryption considered a munitions. And you know, there was clearly a very vocal debate around clipper chip and many other things. And it got to a point where the practicality of the availability of source code for strong encryption made it such that it just didn't make sense to try to restrict where software with strong encryption went. And there were many negatives. I do worry if there are people talking about trying to solve this problem of bad actors or adversarial nation states using AI for nefarious purposes. I don't think it's practical to limit that by trying to control the technology. I think we proved in the 90s that that approach just doesn't work, and it definitely wouldn't work in 2018.
How do we begin to detect these AI-driven attacks then? If we think about it, creating better spear phishing campaigns, we know we have an awful lot of sensor points around. You yourselves talk about having more than a billion sensor points. Context is king across anything we do in security. Are we able to get enough context around these new machine-driven attacks to be able to detect them early enough to stop them? Or are we going to have to wait for a given number of successful attacks before we build up enough of a body to be able to identify them?
It's going to be a combination of both. In many ways, it can help us build new forms of threat intelligence, but we have to understand the reality of what threat intelligence is actually doing. Threat intelligence on its own is not going to prevent an initial attack vector. And by definition, threat intelligence needs to have been created by observing some sort of malicious activity in the wild. What threat intelligence can do is change the economics for the bad actor. We can use threat intelligence and the sharing of threat intelligence to force an actor to convert OPEX into R&D. So if we can make it so a bad actor can't take the exact same attack and execute it continuously on a large number of organizations, but have to constantly retool and change that, all of the energy and investment that they would otherwise have put into running the attack, at least a portion of that now has to be repurposed into continuing to update their technology, which in some ways sounds bad, but if it's preventing them from using as much energy to execute the attack, that's ultimately going to be better for all of the organizations participating in that approach.
It's often easy to think that as technology advances, we gain an edge, we start to win. It seems like this battle's on for a very long time.
I see no end in sight.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thanks so much for having me.